Mayor Aceves?
Here.
Mayor Protem Bennett?
Here.
Councilmember Easton?
Here.
Councilmember Farr?
Here.
Councilmember Perotti?
Here.
And now we will begin with the flag salute. Dr. Cash?
Flag is behind me. Please stand. Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Dos Pueblos. This is our annual opportunity to get together with the Goleta City Council to talk about shared interests, shared goals, and opportunities for our two municipalities to work together. Mayor Aceves, would you like to say a few words before?
Well, thank you. As I was driving over here, I was trying to think of the first time we met as a joint meeting, and that was actually 2009. And I had the honor of serving as mayor the first time for that one, and here we are again. This has become a fantastic opportunity for the electeds to work together, but also staffs to work together and share ideas and goals and create future agenda items, not only for future meetings, but also for future issues that we can work together. In the past, as you remember, we've talked about energy efficiency. We talked about joint powers agreements. And I think a lot of work has been accomplished, but there's still a lot of work to be done. Now, we're only 11 years old. We had our birthday in February. So in education terms, I think we'd be in sixth grade.
That sounds right.
That's about right.
You're sixth graders, maybe?
So we're certainly very anxious to get into junior high school. So. So thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you. And we will begin our meeting with public comment. We do have Shannon Thoitz as well as John Dent that will be coming up together and giving us a presentation about the Dos Pueblos yearbook. Thank you. And the school board meeting on our campus to present the city with a copy of our newly award-winning last year's yearbook. Let me emphasize, this is the 2012 yearbook, so this came out in last June. But what we've recently won is the Gold Crown Award from the Columbia Scholastic Press Association. This is given out by Columbia University every year to the top yearbooks in the country. We are one of 23 recipients nationwide. This places us in the top 1% of yearbooks everywhere. We are the first book to win it from the Central Coast and the only book to win it from Southern California this year. This award is given a year after the book comes out. We actually just finished the 2013 book here. I'm still catching up on my sleep from finishing that one a few days ago. But so Mr. Dent's holding our award here. This is going to be displayed in the school. So I'd like to take this opportunity to give the book to City Council.
Thank you, Shannon. And I'm really excited because my staff has produced another amazing book, and I'm confident that this year's book will be in the same realm as last year's. But I'm also excited because we've got a whole new world of yearbook that we're about to present. And I've got a little demonstration that is going to be up on the screen over there in a minute. And this demonstration is showing you what anybody can do on their own tablets or devices in their own homes. And so you can see right now, that is my screen on my iPad, and this works on any tablet, any Android or iOS tablet or device. And there is an app called Erasma, and I wish I could take any claim to it, but I have no claim to it. This app was designed by a company in Britain and recently purchased by HP for a large sum of money. And this app allows us to add content that's virtual content. It's called augmented reality. So if I go to the page with my picture, my portrait on it, I have added what's called an aura to it. And if I can get it to focus here, should change. And you'll see that I've put a picture up that tells me to go to page 19. And this is a little scavenger hunt that I set up on this book specifically to demonstrate what this looks like. So this is an activity, page 19 is an activity that happens on our campus. And now not only can we see the activity in a picture, but now we can watch a video all about it, we can see other things, and so it sends us into another reality. That reality is something that, ironically, my students envisioned probably along the lines of Harry Potter when they were here 3 years ago. Some of my students created a video that talked about the yearbook coming to life. Now, we really are making this yearbook come to life. This year's book, I'm aiming for 50% of the book to have content like that in it. So that means that when they go over their book with their tablet or device, they can hear their friends talking, they can see that that touchdown, that home run, and they can celebrate it all over again in video without any other QR codes or other things printed in the book, whatever image. And they can add it themselves to their own copies. So in other words, to be able to watch the ones that I'm showing you here, you have to follow. Just like in Facebook or Instagram, you have to follow along with Dos Publish Yearbook. But if friends want to create some for their friends, they just have to follow each other, and they have their own auras in the book. So they can look back and see and hear their friends talk directly to them by going over it. So this is a video that was created 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, by my students. I don't know.
The yearbook, it brings our story to life.
I'm an athlete. How are you, Lucy?
I'm an artist. I'm a photographer.
I'm a whiz kid.
So Jostens bought that and paid my students money for that and used it as a national ad campaign. Little did we know that 2.5 years later, we would actually make that come to life and make it a reality. And so watch for our 2013 book. It will be out at the end of May, and we hope to be on news everywhere with the most innovative yearbook in the country.
Wow. Thank you, Mr. Dent. So perhaps Mr. Dent can teach us how to use some of these techniques in our own meeting. It can be virtual in different ways in the years to come. We're going to start off our meeting with some agenda items, and I believe the first is a presentation on the Goleta Slate, State of the City, by Mr. Singer. City Manager.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the board and council. Since it's been about 18 months, I think, since we last met, and there are, of course, a couple of new faces here, and since so much has occurred in the city since that last time that we met, I thought it would be nice to spend a couple minutes just talking about some of the major accomplishments of the city. Now, of course, it's easy for me to be a cheerleader, too, and spend lots of time doing that, but I really wanted to focus on what were the major activities in the last 18 months that have happened in the city. And there's a lot we've left off the list, but we also didn't want to take too much time in doing this. So we put together a PowerPoint. I believe you have copies in front of you and, of course, have it on the screen. One of the more significant things that happened a little over a year ago was a public opinion survey that we did. We did this in preparation of a measure that we placed on the ballot in November. And one of the opportunities it provided us was to gauge the community's support for the city as a whole and the council and the direction that the city was going. We had done a similar survey in 2008, and so we were able to compare to that survey some of the same question or responses to questions that we asked. And so two of the things that I wanted to draw out here were questions about the city council itself. And the question was whether the council has significantly improved its job approval rating. It was about 60%, either very favorable or favorable, back in 2008, and has gone up all the way to 75% last year. And that's really fairly significant, especially at a time when, after the Bell incident and all the scrutiny of public officials, the opinions of local leaders sometimes is a bit diminished. So the 75% approval rating seemed pretty significant. Maybe as significant was the jump that we saw in the general satisfaction that our residents and folks taking the survey had about the city as a whole, the direction that we're headed. And in fact, the consultant from back east who came and did this phone survey for us and came out and presented this to the council said he had never seen a general satisfaction rating as high as this. It jumped from already a high favorable rating of 65% all the way up to 84%. With less than 10% of our residents feeling that they were not satisfied with the direction that the city was going. So it was really quite significant and helped us launch into a campaign, which I'll talk about in a minute. We've been fortunate to see the movement of some recent capital improvement projects. Notably, it's always fun to put kids up on the screen, and we had a chance to do some major improvements at one of our neighborhood parks just up around the corner from here. Had a nice ribbon cutting when we did that. But one of our largest and most important capital improvement projects is the San Jose Creek project. It's a major flood control project. Actually, it's a flood control facility owned by the county, but we have played a lead role in expanding that flood channel and providing steelhead trout fish passage as part of that project. It's about halfway constructed and will finish later this year. And it means a lot, especially for our Old Town area, because it takes hundreds of parcels out of the federal floodplain, and as such allows them to get out of paying very expensive flood insurance and reinvest in their property. It was a major goal of our redevelopment agency, which is now gone. And part of the result of that is a recent decision by the state that they don't think that we deserve to keep the money to do this project. So you may have seen in the media yesterday and today the state's determination that we should give back the $18 million, we being the city, should give that back to the other taxing entities. And we'll be heading up to Sacramento soon to discuss why it is that they don't agree with how we approached that project, because it was all appropriately and legally done at the time. So that will be probably a protracted discussion with the state. But nevertheless, we're still moving forward with that project. We got to see the construction of our first roundabout at Calle Real in Los Caneros. It's been very well received. It functions beautifully well. And if you don't live in this part of the South Coast region and have a chance to come out, maybe do some Costco shopping, consider going off of Los Caneros and trying it out. It's really a nice addition for us and one that we're very proud of. We also had a chance this last year to be one of the first communities in California to help launch what is a new social network called Nextdoor. Nextdoor is very similar to Facebook, except that it's a closed network only designed for neighborhoods. And so it's based on the establishment of where you live, and you have to qualify yourself to be part of that network. as defined by kind of a boundary around a particular neighborhood. It allows neighbors to really get to know each other. One of the, I think, disadvantages of social media and communication tools is that we stop going next door to ask for a cup of sugar or that kind of thing and conversing with neighbors on the front porch. And so this helps bring people back together, and we've seen a lot of great successes, especially as new residents move into a neighborhood, to be able to reach out on a social network and say, hey, does anybody have a good babysitter, or a reliable plumber, or where can I, you know, find this, that, or the other thing. It also gives the city a further avenue to communicate with our residents. We just found out this last week that we're going to be receiving an award up at a conference later this week for the efforts that our PIO did in helping launch this in our community. And now there's, I think, about 40 or more cities that have used Nextdoor just in the last year, and apparently thousands across the country that are eager to get signed up. But the company that does this is a bit overwhelmed. They're trying to keep up with that demand. So we're glad to have it here and functioning. It's another great communication tool for us. As I noted earlier, the council did support putting a tax measure on the November ballot. It passed easily because our voters were in support of, I think, what it meant for our community. The measure raises our bed tax, our local bed tax, from 10% to 12%, which is matching what both Santa Barbara and a number of other communities in our region have. Coincidentally, there was three other cities in Santa Barbara County that had a similar measure on the ballot in November. They all passed. And so now Carpinteria, Goleta, Santa Barbara, Buellton, and Solvang are all at 12%. This means about a $1.2 million for us a year. So it's a significant revenue source. Speaking of revenues, this last year the city saw the end of part of our revenue neutrality agreement with the county. During that agreement, there was kind of a 10-year period that we called the mitigation period. The end of that 10 years just occurred this last July, and so we were able to see the return of all of our bed tax to the city, as well as 20% more of the sales tax to the city. What continues past the 10 years will be that we'll continue to share property taxes with the county 50-50 in perpetuity, which is a big disadvantage for Goleta over any other city that doesn't have to share its local portion of property taxes. And in addition, perpetually we have to share 20% of our sales tax. But as it related to those, the bed tax, the TOT, and the sales tax ending in July, or that portion coming back to the city, we were able to see some pretty significant revenue increases, and that's represented here in that sales tax went up by about $2 million a year, and our bed tax almost doubled in that same time. When you put those things together with the passage of Measure H, and the establishment of a new hotel, a Marriott Courtyard that's down here on Stork Road, a beautiful hotel if you haven't gotten to check it out, and generally an improved economy, the city's overall revenue projections and outlook are quite strong. So we've gone from just under $16 million a year last year in our general fund to about $20 million this year, and looking at next year to be at about $21 million. Some of that was already anticipated and planned for, so it's not like we just have a huge extra pot of money, but certainly we find ourselves in a much more fiscally friendly environment than we thought we would be in at this time, and we're certainly grateful for that. A couple of other things. We were just last month awarded somewhat of a surprise award that we got, and thanks to our sheriff's local police department through our sheriff's contract. We were one of 100 cities in the entire country of a population of 25,000 or more to be considered one of the top 100 safest cities in the country based on our crime statistics. We ended up being 95th, so there's a little room for improvement there, but we were really honored to see that happen, and it demonstrates the commitment that our council has to public safety, and as you know, and you'll hear a little later on the agenda, also to our campuses in town. The council also has long had a goal of doing more in the area of recreation, and so this last month, they appointed a new Parks and Recreation Commission. It's composed of 7 members, and I would point out that it's hard to see in the picture up there as they're all taking their oath just last month, but one of the 7 members is a student member from Dos Pueblos. That's written into the council's ordinance so that there will always be one student member, either junior or senior in high school, that will be on that commission. So we're grateful to have that participation. We're looking at the creation of an additional park in Old Town, and so the commission will be probably pretty busy in these next few years. And finally, the council has really placed a further emphasis on helping our community be prepared for disasters. And one of the things that we've been active in doing is continuing CERT training. That's emergency preparedness training for residents. Just a couple weeks ago, we graduated our first Spanish-speaking CERT class. We have another one that starts up this weekend. And so we're pleased with the interest in that. Also, our police are doing kind of not a citizens academy, but yeah, maybe it is a citizens academy. So really trying to reach out to the community, help them be prepared for disasters, and especially our lower income families, giving them access to free supplies, disaster kits and things like that. And I'll just end with a really wonderful presentation that we had last month. We brought in a noted author. His name is Peter Kagayama. He's the author of a book called For the Love of Cities. And he came and did some presentations and held a community workshop we had over 125 people at. It was really a pretty important time for Goleta, because as a new community, unlike a city that's been established like Santa Barbara, Goleta still has an opportunity, as the mayor was saying, being only in sixth grade, to really start to form our identity. And this workshop really engaged our community members and our citizens in thinking creatively about what they want out of their community, what kind of traditions they want to form, and rituals and events and things like that. So that was really a rewarding experience, and in fact, we have a follow-up lunch tomorrow that will take some of the folks that were really excited about some new ideas and take that to the next step. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, especially that the board might have, or if the council wants to contribute to anything that I might have overlooked. But that certainly represents the highlights of our last 18 months.
Thank you, Mr. Singer. Board, any questions or comments? Dr. Buss?
A couple questions. One is just more of a curiosity question about the sales tax and the split between the county. Enlighten me and tell me why that is the case.
So when a city incorporates in the state of California, ever since 1993, I believe, you have to form a tax exchange agreement with the county. The notion is to create some neutral impact on revenues and services at the county level, at least for a period of time. And in most new communities that have formed, there's been over a dozen new cities in the last 15 years or so, in most cases, those agreements, which are negotiated, you know, between the new city and the county, have a sunset. In some counties, for example, they treat it somewhat formulaically. They'll come in and say, okay, anyone that wants to incorporate, here's what you need to know, you know, and over 7 years or 10 or 12 years, you'll have to give us a lot of your revenues, but then that'll phase out. In other counties, sometimes it's a little longer than that, even as much as 20 years. In our case, we have what's largely considered the worst revenue neutrality agreement in the state of California, in that it takes so much of our local revenues and commits it to the county perpetually. There is no sunset for that 50-50 property tax split. The sales tax portion had been 50-50, and it's now 70-30. And so I can't really speak to what the justification of including that portion was, but essentially the whole negotiation was based on a financial analysis that was done, an independent analysis. And there was a number of about $3.3 million a year that was identified as needing in order to make the county whole. But what they did is, rather than commit $3.3 million of revenues from the city to the county, they decided to use major tax sources and do that on a percentage basis. So as of year one, the city was already in for like $5.1 million, which exceeded the 3.3. And that just grew all the way to like $8 million plus a year. And then as of this last year, has now come back to about $5.5 million because of those two sources that come back to us. So that's the history. It leaves us at a significant disadvantage in terms of the delivery of services to our residents and businesses and visitors, because that's a huge chunk of change. I mean, you see our overall budget of $20 million. If we had 25, imagine the things that we could do.
Thank you. And actually, I had a second question too as well. Is do you all have any future plans for redevelopment of Old Town?
It's a very appropriate question, because the council just had some discussions this last month about that and is planning to continue those discussions. I can let the mayor speak to it a little further. There's clearly a strong commitment to continuing the revitalization efforts absent the funding that comes with redevelopment. What that looks like is something that we're going to have to continue to talk about.
Thank you. We are starting off on a public process to discuss what that's going to look like moving forward. Of course, we had counted on the redevelopment agency to assist in funding the revitalization. But now with that gone away, we have to find other funding sources. So council's had considerable discussion on this as far as how we're going to fund this. Now we're going to be, because now we're going to have to use citywide funds instead of funds that were used just for that particular district. And so it's a question of prioritization of what gets funded, what gets accomplished. But every one of my colleagues, we all ran with the goal of revitalizing Old Town. So that is still our highest priority, but we certainly have some challenges ahead. So, and we do have two of my colleagues are serving on the committee that will be cheerleading that effort to find out how we can get it done and what it's going to look like at the end of the road.
Ms. Parker?
Mr. Singer, on your public opinion survey, just have a demographics question that I don't know about the city of Goleta. There are sort of snapshots of the top group, satisfied, not satisfied. What is your largest group in terms of age, age demographics in Goleta?
Boy, putting me on the spot. We have a fairly even distribution. Mm-hmm. When looking at the 2010 census, but I don't have it completely committed to memory. I will tell you the nice thing about the 2010 census is it was the first opportunity for the city to really have good demographic information, because we incorporated a year after the 2000 census. Mm-hmm. And so our census information is based not on our boundaries, but on a larger part of the Goleta Valley. There's a pretty good distribution in looking between the data from 2000 to 2010, even though it's Goleta Valley, not just the city. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of interesting trends that we saw. One is certainly an aging population. The other is a reduced household size in those 10 years, which I think follows a similar trend in California, if not the nation. And we also saw increases in some of our minority populations, which I don't think was a surprise either. We have about Asian American, Pacific Islander categories, about 10% of our overall population. And the Latino population went up not as significantly as some areas, and I don't remember what the exact percentage was. But age breakdowns I don't have committed to memory.
Thank you.
Any other questions, board or council members? All right. Thank you, Mr. Singer.
Thank you.
Moving on, we're going to hear from Dr. David Cash, our superintendent, about the Santa Barbara Unified School District strategic plan.
Thank you, President Lamone, members of the council, Mr. Mayor, and board members. First, I want to recognize and thank Sean Carey, the principal at Dos Pueblos High School, for hosting us today. Sean's an outstanding educator in our community, was a fantastic teacher, and is one of the best high school principals I've ever had the pleasure to work with. So thank you, Sean, for getting us set up today. I have some sad news to report. You're only going to listen to me today because Mr. Sumpner is ill, very ill, and will be out the rest of the week, actually, and is unable to be here. So get used to my voice. I'll try to modulate so I sound like a different person so you don't, no one falls asleep. So I'll start with the district's strategic plan, which is this document that you all have in front of you. It's also on our website, and if anyone's ever interested in the Spanish edition, we have those as well. Briefly, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the process that we engaged in, and then I am not going to read the plan. Ms. Parker's nodding her head. Thank goodness. But I would like to highlight parts of it because I think that's important. And if I miss some parts, I don't want anyone to think that those parts aren't as important as the ones that I highlight, because the entire plan has got a lot of good work for us to do. We assembled a task force of pretty eclectic task force in our community. The city of Santa Barbara was represented, Santa Barbara City College, UCSB was represented, teachers, parents, community members. We had a member from a nonprofit was on board, and we also had the presidents of our two bargaining units, the California Schools Employees Association and the Santa Barbara Teachers Association, all of whom were on the task force. The task force met over a span of about 12 months is the process. We had 11 official meetings, several smaller meetings with smaller subgroups. We held 6 community forums, 2 of which were held out here at Dos Pueblos High School. We also provided the community with the opportunity to give us input via a button on our webpage, and we received over 200 responses and input to the strategic plan electronically, which was really great. The board approved the strategic plan this past fall, and we have in earnest started our work on the strategic plan beginning this January. As it's stated on the front page, what we started with were 3 essential questions that the task force asks ourselves in order to inform the work that we'd be doing in creating a draft of the plan to present to the board. And those questions were, what are our school district's goals? How do we expect to reach those goals? And how will we measure success in our district's delivery of education? Those questions, it was a robust conversation throughout the process. It was a lot of fun listening to people talk, and there was a lot of passion in the room around a whole host of issues. And it resulted in what we're calling our 4 aims for our school district. And they're broken into, I think, easily understood categories: life, career, and college-ready students, student, family, and community engagement, organizational transformation, and facilities. And within each one of those 4 aims, we have several action steps that we're committed to taking over the next 3 years. Some of those actions we'll be taking every year because they're things that we don't do once and check the box and say, been there, done that. The best example of that, to kind of contextualize that for you, is improving student achievement. We wouldn't just say, within 1 year, we're going to improve student achievement, and now we're done. That's obviously something we need to work on each and every year for the kids that are in our schools for a whole host of reasons, one of which is that our student population changes every year. And so we have to account for the fact that we have new kids in our system every year, and we want every student every year to have an opportunity to improve in their academic achievement. Some of the highlights within this first aim, which are really to have our students life, career, and college ready. And kind of to underscore that is the belief that there are multiple pathways for student success. I was really proud of that conversation. It was very interesting to listen to parents and teachers. And also the president of the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce also had a lot of good input in that as well. And it was really what we want are happy, productive people once they leave school. Not everybody needs to go to Harvard and get a BA. We'd certainly like some of our students to do that, but not everybody needs to do that. So understanding that we need to have a school that's going to meet the needs of a very diverse student body and get them prepared for what they want to do and what our community needs when they leave our system was really important. So some of the highlights in that are high expectations for every student, and obviously that includes increasing the academic achievement for everybody. There was a lot of conversation also around and in the plan having visual arts and performing arts experiences for students, making those available. That was really important. We didn't want to forget that it wasn't just one side of the brain, it was also the other side of the brain, and those experiences help make what we think is a vibrant community and great kids. In addition to that was a big focus on what we call STEM, which is essentially science, technology, education, math. It is a great opportunity for us to work hard in the area of what we believe will be the dominant 21st century job market. So we're excited about that. Also in there is the idea that every student will have a 10-year plan. And that would be an academic plan that would result in a career choice, and they would work towards that with stops along the way, getting information. So very exciting. And since Mr. Rickman's in here, I would be in trouble if I didn't also mention he's our director of technology. That contained within that would be a wall-to-wall technology environment for our students with one-to-one computing for every child. Other actions within our first aim, which is our life, career, and college-ready students, would include improving outcomes for our special needs students. We don't want to leave, you know, the no child left behind construct has gotten a lot of bad press, but the thought behind it, I believe, is really important. It's kind of the essence of what we want to do is ensure that we get to every kid. And that means we need to expand the work that we're doing for students in the classroom. And in particular, we really need to work on those transitions from elementary school to junior high, from junior high to high school, and from high school to the community. Those are really important transitions for any student, but they're especially important transitions for students with special needs. That change in environment, that change in placement from the kind of cocooning of one classroom elementary school to a multiple classroom junior high of 800 to 1,000 students, to a multiple classroom high school of several thousand students. Those are really important transitions, and then ultimately out into our community. And so that's also very important, and that's a big part of the work that we're doing as a result of the strategic plan. We're also in this area looking at how we can train our staff. You're going to hear me talk in a second. I'll be modulating my voice. About the Common Core State Standards, which is a huge change in what's going to be happening in K-12 education. And that's going to require a lot of work with our teachers, a lot of work with our parents, a lot of work with the community, a lot of work with our kids on what our expectations will be for students and how teachers will deliver the instruction over the next several years. We've got some great partnerships with some existing colleges and universities, and we're going to look to expand those as they will help us implement the Common Core. And finally, in this area, I think it's important to talk about addressing the unremitting, unchanging, hopefully soon to change, gap in achievement and opportunity between students in our schools and in our community. We have, unfortunately, a persistent gap in the achievement and I believe in opportunities for students who, and the two dominant groups typically are students of color who are economically disadvantaged versus students, white students who are economically advantaged. And we hope that the work that we're going to do is going to eliminate that gap and ensure that every student is working at or above grade level. We have to be firmly committed to that because nothing good is going to happen for our community until every student who leaves our system becomes a productive citizen in our community. I can't think of a more important mission for a school district to engage in other than that. There's a lot of work we'll do in there. We have some work in relationship to cultural proficiency, how our teachers can relate to students who grew up in a different home than they did, have a different background than them, and how our system or our school district works to ensure that every student gets the same opportunity, regardless of what neighborhood they live in. So I didn't talk about everything in AIM 1 because I don't want to read it, but that's kind of an example of the work we're going to do in relationship to preparing students for their life, college, and career. AIM 2 is about engaging our community, our students, and our family. The subtext to this is a strong belief that families are our most important partners in education. And recognizing and celebrating the families that send their kids to our schools every day is extraordinarily important. And that means it's incumbent upon us to figure out ways to engage them, not to simply say, hey, you know, we're the school, come to us, but for us to actively engage them. And that means a whole host of different strategies because we've got a ton of different families in our community. Very exciting for us. We've got a lot of neat things we're looking at doing that. We know that we have to have a different set of engagement strategies for parents at different schools. High school parents are different than elementary parents, are different than junior high school parents. The level of expectations as far as commitment and engagement are also different. And that's really important to us to recognize that and for us to take the lead and own that and increase those opportunities. Very, very important. We're also moving forward with what we think will engage our family and community through having a learning management system, which is a web-based interface. And I'm probably going to really make mistakes here, so Mr. Rickman, please jump in when I make a mistake about this, that will allow our community and our families to interact through the web with the school district, individual teachers to learn how kids are doing, whether kids are, whether they showed up for the first period, what their grades were, what homework they're missing, for teachers to work with groups of students electronically, for students to work in groups also on the same assignment. Really, I think just a fantastic opportunity for kids and parents to continue to be engaged in what's happening, because we know not every parent can get to a school, but they certainly might be able to get to a place where there's internet access and find how to communicate with people at the school. We also are going to increase educational opportunities for parents. I had twice a year I meet with faith-based leaders in our community, and today this was, I would say, one of the dominant things that came out in the meeting I had today with our faith-based leaders, and that was we need to increase educational opportunities for parents in our community. And we have an emerging, I believe, pretty strong partnership with Santa Barbara City College I'm excited about, where they're already on our campus doing some good work for parents. They can do more. But we also have, that started right here at Dos Pueblos with Sal and Linda Guadagna, a really great way through a number of organizations to come to schools and go through a series of courses for mostly our Spanish-speaking parents so that they can navigate, understand, and be successful in advocating for their children in our schools. But we know we need to do more of that. And finally, in this area, we're really looking to make our schools community centers. We think it's really important to do so. There's a tight line right now. We're kind of rubbing up against the idea of having a community center and safe schools. What does that look like? But we believe that we have a tremendous and valuable asset that we're responsible for, all of our schools, and that they should be the centers of these neighborhoods. They should be places that are seen by our neighbors that can be used actively. And we've got some good examples, and our goal is just to expand upon them. AIM 3 is organizational transformation, and that really the subtext for that is that we want to put students first in every decision that we make. And we're going to transform or continue to transform our organization, understanding that. And my little phrase I live by is every child, every chance, every day. And that's the idea that it's every decision has to be based upon meeting the needs of our students. Well, we don't want any student to be anonymous in who they are and what they need. And we're going to do some surveying. We hope to have some pretty good climate surveys where we're going to survey kids, parents, community members, and our staff about how well our school is or is not working. And a significant part of that is to ensure that our budget is aligned with the belief that students are always first. Within that, two last things I want to talk about is that we believe very strongly that diversity of our schools and our community is one of our greatest strengths. We don't see that as a liability. We see second language learners as having a strength that we must learn from and learn about. Being multilingual is an extraordinary asset in the 21st century, and it's incumbent upon us to not only recognize that, but capitalize that and expand that to our monolingual students, parents, and community, including myself. And finally, we want to become as transparent as possible. And this is always, I always chuckle at this because, as I'm sure you all know, just trying to translate the state accounting code to any normal person is extraordinarily difficult. And so being transparent, I think we've started down a good path. Our last budget presentation, I think, was pretty user-friendly. But we're trying to get out of educational ease and more into a way in which our information is accessible. And our last aim was facilities. And I just want to tell you that all of the issues in relationship to our facilities will be guided by a sustainability model. We have just completed an assessment of our district facilities, the first complete assessment that we've done in many, many, many years. And from that, we will create a comprehensive facilities master plan. And it'll be incumbent upon me to look for options other than the taxpayer to help finance our facility needs. Our strategic plan, I think, is bold. It's ambitious. It's going to take the work of everybody in our community to make it happen. Stay tuned. Various parts of it, we have a pretty tight timeline on what we're going to be doing over the next 3 years, and over the next several months we'll be reporting out to the public at board meetings the work that we've completed to date. So I'm welcome to take any questions anyone has about it.
Thank you, Dr. Cash. Any questions or comments? Councilmember Easton?
High schools, it seems to me, have, I don't want to say a standard role, but they occupy a known location in the educational hierarchy. How does high school at this point respond to what has to be seen as a retreat by the state from the next level of education? The university system is going to not a state-funded organization, but a pupil-funded organization. Similarly, that the community colleges are overwhelmed and the funds aren't provided. How do you prepare students for that future? What do you tell them? Because it looks really kind of horrendous.
That's a really good question.
I didn't ask you to solve the problem.
I know. Hopefully, I can at least tell you some of the things that we do. I think the most important thing we can do is give as many students as possible the opportunity to earn college credit while they're in high school so they can get a leg up and potentially reduce the expenses they may have as a student in college. We have Santa Barbara City College, which just recognizes the number one community college in America by the Aspen Institute, and I would say there's a really strong reason for that, one of which is their dual enrollment program. We have, I just looked at the data today, we have about 1,500 students, 1,600 maybe, currently enrolled in college courses at City College right now today that are earning college credit as well as credit toward high school graduation. An incredible opportunity for kids. If you were to go up to Santa Maria, down to Ventura, those don't exist. We're lucky because of that really great relationship we have. In addition to that, we probably have between, and I haven't looked at the numbers lately, so this is, I'll give you a wild guess, between 25 and 150 students attending the university, or earning University of California Santa Barbara credit as well, while also earning credits toward graduation. Those are really important community partners and really important opportunities for kids. We're in a position now where we hope that many of our students in high school will be able to earn an AA or at least their first year of college, their general education credits, while simultaneously earning a high school diploma with our district. So that's the kind of work we're doing. But I couldn't agree with you more, being a parent of a 21-year-old. I watched when he was in the Cal State University system, our cost in the Cal State University system changed dramatically from year one to year three. So I understand that. It is a conundrum and a problem that we need to continue to look for solutions within our own control.
Ms. Parker.
I just have to respond to that, too, because it's so incredibly timely that Mr. Heron and I were outside of this building talking to one of the Dos Pueblos AVA teachers, Mr. Kevin McKee, who was saying that their 12th grade AVID class, which is our advancement via individual determination class, where we're taking kids that are strong learners but are usually first generation going to college, and giving them extra support, extra counseling, college trips, and really push for them to go to four-year universities. And he was saying they've gotten great acceptance rate here at Dos Pueblos, and now a number of the students are facing the reality that with the financial packages that are coming back to them, that they really cannot afford to go. And most of them went the UC and Cal State route. There may be more opportunities in the private college world for financial aid, but it's truly a shame and a difficulty and something that we need to be. We do have City College here as a great and less expensive option, but when we're pushing so hard for these especially disadvantaged students to go to 4 years, right out of the gate, right out of high school, it's very disappointing, and it is something that the high schools really need to be thinking about. How do we message that, and how do we help them? So thank you for bringing that up.
President Limon.
Mr. Heron.
Yeah, just a comment on the facilities. We had a great discussion at our board meeting last Tuesday, and it's something that you as elected officials, may hear about, because I'm looking for input. We passed bond to raise funds for facilities, and we have some $200-300 million worth of needs, and we are faced now with potentially selling some more of those bonds that we're authorized to sell. My conundrum is, in the process of that bond election, we sort of said what the tax rate would be, and we would structure bonds to sell them at a certain tax rate. As it turns out, if we do sell more bonds, we're not going to be able to live by that estimate. The tax rate may go up. And so as in Goleta, you have the secondary district. And my conundrum is the need for the facilities outweigh changing the tax rate higher than what we had sort of implied in the election campaign? And so we're going to be discussing that in the next couple of weeks probably to determine whether we should sell more bonds, increasing the tax rate, or not selling them because it would be going against the will of the voters when we pass the tax rate. And so we're going to have that discussion, and you may hear from your constituents that we might be having a higher tax rate from $12, $13 per 100,000 evaluation up to $17, $18 for assessed valuation. It's already 17. And so I'd appreciate any feedback from the community as to how do they balance those two priorities of more bonds, doing more repairs on our schools, getting them into a status where, we need help on our facilities, or not selling more bonds. So it's going to be an interesting discussion. I'd love the community input on that. I'm looking forward to it. And anything you guys can add and gals can add to the equation would be helpful.
Welcome to politics.
You know, if I can respond to that, just as a comparison with what we have to deal with here in the city, is that we're going to receive a report on Tuesday dealing with the status of our roadways. And what we're finding is the longer we wait, the more it's going to cost us. And I think that's probably a good analogy with your capital improvements. You know, you obviously have prioritized, but the longer you wait, the more it's going to cost you. And unfortunately, you don't have control over the interest rates, and it is what it is. But I think when it comes time to pulling the trigger, you know, you got to look at the facilities as the highest priority. So it's an interesting discussion. I think people are visual. They'll see where the money's going. And I think that's why the school bond measures have been so successful, because people have seen the conditions of the facilities and all the improvements and the work that you've done to show where you put the money. Look what you did at San Marcos High School. That was an incredible, incredible facility. I did have a question, Dr. Cash, on your presentation. I want to go all the way back to your AIM 1, because I think it's kind of like the core of your whole program, and that is you talked about the 10-year plan. And as you're, I tried to listen to and read at the same time, and I found that the 10-year plan started at the sixth grade.
Yes.
Can you just cover that again? But also, you said touch points, but what about follow-up? And does that include those that choose to go to college and not go to college, as to find out whether your strategic plan was well-centered to begin with?
It did start in the, like this time of a student's sixth grade year, when they make the transition to junior high school, give them an opportunity to think about the coursework they might want to begin taking in grades 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. And it recognizes that students hopefully will learn about themselves and about their interests and will make changes along the way. When they get to high school, it'll be part of a required course that they take, every freshman takes, which goes to a really systematic process at looking at their career choices and opportunities. And then it's integrated into a student's English language arts courses in grades 10 and 11. So they will be back looking at these plans. I was just, this was a high school I was visiting this week. And I was in that lab in this class talking to two kids working on their 10-year plan, and there was an empty chair, and I sat down next to one guy, and I said, well, gosh, you know, what do you think of this? Is this any good, what we're doing here? We're, you know, making you go through all this stuff. Are you learning anything? And the kid looked at me and he said, yeah, I really thought I wanted to be an emergency room doctor, and then I found out those guys work all the time. I want to work that much. And I talked to the other guy next to me, and I said, you know, same question, is this any good? You know, we're making you guys take this. I want to know, is it worthwhile? And he said, you know, yeah, I had no idea how much a four-bedroom house cost in Goleta. He goes, I'm going to have to make $100,000 a year to afford a house. And he said it completely. He's now, you know, I'm going to go to college. I'm going to go to city college. He had like a complete plan he shared with me. And these are two random kids. I could have sat down and had two random kids tell me, oh, this is a piece of junk. I hate it, probably. But it was amazing to me. I mean, I did not know what to expect, and I asked them both the same question. So I thought, there's probably some really good conversations occurring at homes and between kids and between teachers and adults on this campus. And that's the same. All of our high schools have this program. Santa Barbara High, I think it was the first high school to get it, then San Marcos, and DP's been the last one to implement it. But a really neat part of the 10-year plan. And it does definitely include the idea that kids aren't going to all go to college right after graduating from high school.
Let me stick in, because I think the idea of career is dead. The idea that you are going to go out, learn how to do something, and then be able to do that for the rest of your life, it's not happening anymore. Change is too rapid. I've changed my career four times since I got out of college. It seems to me that the one thing that allowed me to do that was that I was taught how to learn early in the process. And I watched my sons do the same thing. One's on his third, one's on his fourth. And they're in their 40s. So just focusing on what am I going to do when I get out of high school seems to me a little bit close to career education, to vocational school. Now, I come out of a liberal arts background, so forgive my bias.
Well, you're going to like what I'm going to say last about the Common Core, because the context of the Common Core is creating kids that are career and college ready, that the skill set that's most important is problem solving, critical thinking, which are is the skill set that you obviously utilize to change careers. And that's very different than what we've been doing over the last decade.
Thank you, Dr. Cash. I believe Councilmember Perotti has a question or two.
Yes, thank you. First, as a comment, I just want to applaud the Santa Barbara Unified School District for this strategic plan. It is ambitious and bold, but I think it's just right in step with where we need to go at this time. And I think it's just fabulous, especially the part about parent engagement. That's so critical. I'm just curious. I know, having raised two daughters and both of them graduating from this high school, how are you facilitating the engagement with students and counselors? I know there's probably such a need to have more counselors. I know you have a pretty large population of students here. Are you working on getting more counselors, or are they sufficient the amount? I would think the students, I mean, they'll have a 10-year plan and they'll be working independently with their teachers, but how's this counseling going?
Well, we have a pretty straightforward student-to-counselor ratio, and I would have to say that most every decision that any governmental entity, us included, makes is the context is our pie is limited. And so everyone has to make kind of strategic choices on where the allocations are made. With that, with saying that, one of the beautiful things that we're about to begin engaging in, the Common Core, is less is more in the classroom. And there's going to be, I believe, a greater opportunity for students to not be anonymous or feel anonymous and to be kind of rushed through a system, and a greater opportunity for deeper connections between the adults on campus and the kids on campus. And I think that isn't always necessarily the counselor, though they're primarily the person, that becomes the most important person to a student at school. The most important adult for me growing up when I was at Hill Junior High School in Long Beach, California, was the head custodian, who was, I thought was the funniest guy on earth. He was college educated, went to Berkeley, and just decided he wanted to work as a custodian. And he spent the time to talk to me. I think my fear is what's happened to us in our K-12 system is that we've either lost unintentionally or through our organization the importance of time with children. Mm-hmm. And one of the hoped for outcomes of the Common Core, because there will be fewer content standards to cover, is that there will be greater opportunities to make those connections.
Great, thank you.
May I comment on that?
Mr. Hearn?
I think Mrs. Parker and I, probably one of the proudest things we've done over the last 5 years, is when I joined the board, there was an attempt to increase the number of students per counselor. In many different ways it was tried. And I think we both, at that time, fought to keep it as low a ratio as we could. And we succeeded and hasn't changed, even though during the toughest budgetary times we had, we managed to keep that ratio without worsening the situation. So that's one of the things I'm very proud of, is we could use more counselors, we could lower that ratio, but the fact that we've maintained it and during difficult times, I think, is a great accomplishment.
Ms. Parker?
Full disclosure, I've been on the board longer than Mr. Heron, and so I have served on a board that cut the counseling ratio, so that there are we preserved it at a certain level once Mr. Heron came on, but it got hit so hard at one point that we lost what the California, the state of California had provided for you know, fewer students per counselor. So we lost that originally, and it is a loss. And I'm sorry that we have not been able to get back. It's all that we can do and have been able to do is, as Mr. Heron says, maintain at the somewhat higher level. But it's particularly hard as we're trying to get more and more students into universities and qualify for their A through Gs, and there's just so much on a counselor's plate that sometimes when they're trying to deal, because most of them it's close to 400 students per counselor. How do you manage that? How do you really give each child, each student, the services they need? It's difficult.
Thank you. And I would like to add, in light of Dr. Cash's comments and our ideas of making our schools part of the community and our community part of our schools, I would welcome the opportunity for perhaps the Citizens Academy or one of the future CERT classes to actually be a partnership with the district and maybe be held here for parents and community members here. So perhaps a discussion in the future, but hearing both of your presentations, I thought, wow, that's an opportunity. Maybe we can involve our school community to be part of those. All right. Well, with no further comments on this item, we will move on to talking about a very important issue, safe schools and our truancy program. And it will be Dr. Cash and Deputy George Hedricks.
So I'll do my best Marlon Sumpner imitation. He has a very dry wit, so I don't know that I can.
And perhaps we can invite our deputy
yes,
to come to
come
the
up.
DP Chargers podium. Thank you.
I'll start by just saying we've done a tremendous amount of work since December in relationship to the Sandy Hook tragedy. We want to publicly acknowledge the work of the Sheriff's Office through the City of Goleta and their help. Butch Arnaldi, I've known for, I'll just say, a long time. And he is always someone I can call on to and count on to be extraordinarily supportive to our schools in Goleta. And it's a pleasure to work with them. And I can't tell you as a principal how important the SRO position was for me, how it continues to be an extraordinarily vital part of the school climate at Dos Pueblos. And I want to very quickly talk a little bit about the SARB, and then I'll let Officer Hedricks talk. We are engaged in a county truancy prevention program again. District Attorney Joyce Dudley revitalized the truancy prevention program, and we're back in the midst of it. And Mr. Sumpner wanted me to mention that it would be safe to say that there have been between 40 and 50. SARB is a student attendance review board. It's when a student gets to a specific number of truancies that they are referred with their parents to a hearing over the past 2.5 months. For the most part, the chronic truants continue to have attendance problems. However, the habitual truants have shown improvement. And he states that 95% of the cases are at Goleta Valley. Not of all the cases. 95% of the cases are secondary with only a couple of elementary schools. Schools are taking a very aggressive approach to the truancy issue, holding the after-school mediation meetings and the one-on-one with the student, parent, and administrator meetings. And the truancy mediation team, which is the team that has the parents, the counselors, the DA, the nurse, the psychologist, the youth services specialist. It's really the big group that brainstorms strategies on keep getting kids to school, are also working very well. He rates the program, because we've only been going for 2.5 months now, as a success. So I wanted to make sure that that information was shared with the City Council. We're happy with that, and we look forward to that continuing. And thank you, Officer Hedricks, for your great work here at Dos Pueblos.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome to our campus. My name is George Hedricks. I'm the school resource deputy here, entering the near end of my second official school year here. So my sophomore year is coming to an end. And really, last year was kind of an eye-opening for me. When I spoke to you last year, I'd kind of just gotten the position. I would say not much has changed since then, but it has quite a bit. The kids are – I'm getting used to them. They're young, man. They're fast. As you saw from the presentation earlier, the technology is out there, and the kids are up on it. So I'm constantly trying to keep up with them. But But when I got the position last year, I really, my goal as an SRO, and I think in general as an SRO, is to provide a safe campus for our kids to get an education. And kind of the way I went about doing that is through building relationships. It's very important for me to have relationships with the staff at the school, the students, their parents. The DP sits right in the middle of the neighborhood, so our residents in the neighborhood are very involved in the campus. They're here every day. So it's very important for me to know them, for them to know me when they see me driving around or if they want to stop and talk to me. So that was really my approach. And with that, I found that an SRO wears many caps. I often find myself being a mentor, a counselor. I help with sports, coaching. You specifically asked me about football last year. I think they made some steps forward. They're getting there. No thanks to me, but they are getting better. And then obviously...
I think it was baseball, wasn't it?
Well, I'm doing baseball, okay. Yeah. But right, <they're>, exactly. And then obviously at times, being in law enforcement, there are times where I am the disciplinary. When maybe an ed code violation or a criminal violation, the school asks me to step in, or if it's something where I need to get involved and help out. So with all that, walking around campus is probably the biggest thing I do to combat all those problems. It's just being available, letting them know who I am, talking with the kids. It's not uncommon to walk during a nutrition break or during lunch break and get some random high fives and some, hey, coach, or hey, I got pulled over yesterday and got a ticket. What's going to happen? They don't know. So it's nice to know that they can come and talk to me about anything, really. Some current trends I want to talk about with the students here at the school. We're still seeing, you know, tobacco use, some marijuana use, and then alcohol. Those are probably the three most common among our teenagers. Truancy, as Dr. Cash spoke about, we do have the kids who are missing a lot of class, or they're not coming to school at all, or they're leaving midway through the day. We do our best to combat that, partly by being in the neighborhood as well and seeing where the kids are at and what they're up to. Social media, Twitter, Facebook. You saw the presentation. I mean, great, I didn't know about that. That's another thing I'm going to have to catch up on now. So, I mean, it's as simple as what this can do. I'm from the BlackBerry Stone Age. I finally moved on to this, and I have the kids here showing me how to use half the stuff on here. So I use them probably as much as they use me as a resource. But with that, you know, Facebook, the cyberbullying, the name-calling, with the text messaging, the Twitter, the Instagram, these are all things they use to send messages, sometimes pictures, sometimes inappropriate content in the pictures. Of course, when parents find out or when they break up and that picture gets shared, I find out. It's something I'm having to combat. And, you know, last computer use I remember from school was playing Oregon Trail. So this stuff is pretty, I mean, it wasn't there when I was in high school. So that was one of the biggest things for me to get used to last year, and now coming again into this year, is how much technology is out there and how good they are at it. I mean, they know their phones. Their phone is their world. And really, there's not much else you could take away from them. If you take your phone away from them, man, they'll let you know. That's a big thing. So they're really dependent on their phones because they do everything for them. So with that being said, those are some of the current trends I'm seeing here and kind of what I may do on a day-to-day basis here at the school.
Thank you. Council members and board, do we have questions or comments? Mr. Heron?
I would just like to comment. We did pass a resolution Tuesday night regarding the gun violence situation. So I hope that that resolution gets in the hands of the city council members, and I hope the press also makes use of that and spreads the word of the resolution and things that we can all do to help. Thank you.
We'll send it to the city of, we sent it to state and federal officials, but we'll send it to cities of Goleta, Santa Barbara, and the county as well.
Thank you.
I just had a question. How do you feel the drug sniffing dogs have been effective here, or what has been the student reaction?
The student reaction is kind of mixed. Sometimes when they see the dog, they like to call out, Skeeter, or, you know, there's another dog as well. But really, a lot of what I've seen is the kids are, they're pretty savvy. They'll park their cars off campus. They know if they keep their stuff in the cars and they park their cars off campus that the dog can't check it. So again, it's good. We combated part of it by getting some of the drugs off campus, but as you see, across the street is across the street. So it is a deterrent. Some of the kids are very pro. Other kids think, how are they paying for this? Why do we have this dog? We don't have a problem, or we'll just park off campus. I see both ends of it, really.
Mayor Aceves.
Thank you. Deputy, I just, you know, as a retired cop, I know the benefit of having you on campus. But it's only as good as having the right person on campus. And everything I've heard, you did a great job, and I commend you for that.
Thank you, sir.
Dr. Cash, I had a question dealing with the SARB.
Yes.
And accountability with the parents.
Well, the SARB process, as you may recall, is pretty similar to what you probably recall when your son was actually a student, but never in SARB.
I'm glad you mentioned it.
And it does have, the whole construct is problem solving with community agencies involved. But eventually it does get to the point where the student and the parent are unable to get the student to school. And there is the consequence with the district attorney's office. But our focus has been on a lot of problem solving. And it was not written into the agreement, but understanding was, for Santa Barbara Unified, was that process we had to bring community agencies to that to help with the problem solving. So, and that has occurred. So it's been good. So when it appears that there's an issue in relationship to drugs and alcohol for the student or parent, we have with us community agencies that can provide services for that.
Okay. And I should clarify, he knows my son because he was his junior high school principal.
Yes.
and high school principal. So.
And he was a great baseball player, speaking of baseball.
Other questions or comments? Well, and I just wanted to thank Officer Hedricks, because you actually welcomed all of us by welcoming us to our campus. And so I think that's just very symbolic of your role here. And it was very, very meaningful. So thank you.
Thank you all.
We are moving on to a little bit about the future, Common Core standards. And Dr. Cash has a presentation for us about the Common Core standards.
6 minutes. So we're about to engage in the implementation of the Common Core State Standards. I'm going to give you a brief history in California. In August 2010, the State Board of Education adopted the Common Core State Standards. These are not national standards. These are standards that have been adopted by 45 states and the District of Columbia. They were not created by the Department of Education, the federal government. They were created by a consortium of educators, professional educators at the college level and at the K-12 level, that got together from about 22 states and came up with what they thought would be a good set of content standards in originally math and English language arts. Just yesterday, the state of California adopted the science standards, the next generation of science standards, which are really very exciting for anyone that has a passion in science. Our process in our district after the adoption was the next school year, which was before I got here, was an informational gathering year. We had district staff and out learning about the Common Core state standards. They attended national conferences with other educational leaders throughout the nation and looked at them. For the 2011-12 school year, we began training staff, particularly principals, our site leaders, and we continued to train teacher leaders throughout our district, both internally and sending them out to listen to the people who actually wrote the content standards. And this past year, we've been training all of our staff, all of our teachers. We have a really great specific process. This is a change in education that's really being led by teachers, because the greatest impact is going to occur in the classroom. Just very quickly, so you have some context, our current system of teaching, learning, and assessment, we have the California Content Standards, which are in four areas: math, science, social studies, and English. It's really content and skill acquisition based, multiple standards. They're repeated throughout a student's K-12, and I forgot my comma or my apostrophe, K-12, a student's K-12 experience. They're mostly a flat, two-dimensional assessment tool. You're all familiar with it. It's a Scantron sheet with a number two pencil. Student bubbles in an answer from kind of what educators call a forced choice, multiple choice system. there will be a significant shift in teaching and learning, and I want to tell you about the shifts in English language arts. And what I'm going to describe not just doesn't apply to English teachers, but this applies in all the content areas as well. The students are going to be expected to build knowledge through content-rich nonfiction and informational texts in addition to literature. So we are not this was also one of those vicious rumors that kids wouldn't read literature anymore when this first came out. There's no abandonment of the great works of literature, and but there will be also an important emphasis on nonfiction and informational texts, which will be very intentional, which we have not done in our K-12 environment. And it's very different to read Harry Potter than it is to read a biology textbook. That's a different set of skills to read it and understand it. And we can't assume that because a student can read Harry Potter, they can read and understand a biology text. And so we are going to be, this is going to force a shift in the teaching that we do in relationship to informational text. Reading and writing will be grounded in evidence from the text. So typically we might ask a student to give us their opinion regarding something. We might ask them to comment on something that they've read. The shift here will be that students will be required to provide evidence to support an opinion that they've given and to demonstrate their understanding through critical thinking skills in relationship to their response to the text. It'll be very different. We're going to have to provide regular practice with what we call complex text, which is text that's rich with academic vocabulary, which will be also very important, which we have not been intentional with up to this particular point. The shifts in mathematics are probably even more significant. Instead of multiple standards being covered each and every year in math, the focus is going to be on 2 to 4 critical areas that are focused on deeply in each grade level, and they may or may not be repeated from grade to grade to grade. The other significant element is coherence, that the concepts are logically connected from one grade to the next and linked to other major topics within the grade, which is very different. The idea that things will not be taught in isolation, that the belief is that a student will have an opportunity to have probability and statistics, algebra and geometry, number sense, those sorts of really important parts throughout their experience, and won't wait to take probability and statistics as a 12th or 11th grader. We'll actually have that woven in beginning in kindergarten. Obviously, it'll be grade level appropriate. And then rigor, fluency with arithmetic, application of knowledge to real-world situations, and a deep understanding of mathematical concepts. I was just here this week, saw an incredible lesson, Common Core lesson, of kids, instead of doing 10, 15 problems on the equation relating to parabolas, they were shooting M&Ms in the air from homemade launching devices that they had made, measuring the length of the M&M as it and the height that it achieved and the time it took to leave the launching device to its landing on the ground, with one group of students responsible for communicating the results, and they were videotaping it and talking about how best they would communicate the results to the rest of the class. Now that is very different than a single student sitting at their desk with their textbook solving equations. The new assessments, we're part of the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium. There's two consortium that are producing the assessments that we'll have. The other is called PARC. They go way beyond the multiple choice questions to include extended response questions and performance tasks that the students will do. And it allows students to demonstrate critical thinking and problem solving. And really key to it is that it's computer adaptive testing. We were very fortunate because it was all random. Our district, there was the assessment is being piloted now, and we had an elementary school picked, a junior high picked, and a high school picked. So, I mean, just very lucky. So we get to see, I was able to see, because it was Peabody, what that looked like for elementary. I'll go to, La Colina was picked for the junior high, I'll go see what they did, and La Cuesta was picked for the high school. So we'll be able to have, and principals have gone and observed it too, a good idea as to what the assessment tools look like. And that one, a key component is computer adaptive. So the way a student answers the question, right, wrong, determines what the next question will be. And it'll be very different for our students who typically get a perfect score on their assessments, who are done in 20 minutes with the assessment because it really doesn't test their knowledge. They'll still have some additional questions that they'll have to answer, which we'll hopefully go through that and they'll understand it. It's not just a summative assessment, meaning kind of an end of the year assessment. It'll also include various tests along the way, so we can see how our kids are doing, see how we need to change instruction. And because it's computer-based, we'll get the results, I think, in 2 weeks after the kids take it. As opposed to right now, this past year, we got the results in October for the test they took it last April. So they weren't very helpful for us in placing kids in classes, informing parents on student achievement. So that will also be good. Our plan, what we're working on right now, if I gave you the whole plan, I'd miss my daughter's open house at Brandon and her piano that she's going to be playing at 5:30. This June, we have teachers working in what we call our professional learning communities, which are teachers getting together that teach the same subject or the same grade level, and they're going to develop units of instruction using the iTunes U as the platform. And iTunes U is a really robust, incredibly vibrant platform for producing lessons because it is immediately publishable, so that when I produce a lesson on it as with my PSC, it'll be available for other teachers at my school to go and look at. It allows the integration of all kinds of digital assets, movies, other lessons, original text, that students can access as part of the unit. So we'll start that process. We have two professional development days in June. And then throughout next year, they'll continue the development of those units. And we have built in an evaluation of those units on two levels. One, are they actually Common Core standards? And two, do they actually improve student achievement? Which, if they don't do that, we're not interested in doing it. So that's the last thing that we'll be doing. And one last thing I wanted to do is to show you some assessment. And I'll have to walk up there and click on that, because I think it'd be good for you to see a sample question. Let's see how those of swimmers swimming across a swimming pool, and it shows their time in hundreds. And the question then asks to the student, explain how the results of the race would change if the race used a clock that rounded to the nearest tenth. A great question. This is for fourth graders. So a great question for kids, and really, it asks them not just what is the right answer, but how do you know that that's the right answer, which is what we want our students to be able to tell us. And so that's very exciting, and it's a quick sample of what awaits all the children, not just in Goleta, but throughout the state of California. So thank you. I'll take any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Dr. Cash. Any questions or comments? Dr. Buss?
You know, one of the things that that perhaps Dr. Cash wants to talk about a little bit, but that really Common Core is going to provide is the tie between education and business and economic development. Because at the heart of Common Core is really not only being college ready, it's career ready.
Yes.
And whether a student chooses to go on to higher education or not, the critical piece is making sure that they become productive citizens within their communities. So that's a huge piece that I think has a lot of implications for cities, City of Goleta, City of Santa Barbara, I think that's one piece that you may want to comment a little more or talk about.
Well, it's the came about because of the belief that we weren't preparing kids to be career ready. We had a lot of kids that could answer questions to discrete bits of information, but they couldn't problem solve. They couldn't think critically. So the focus has moved away from knowledge acquisition as the primary focus and more toward knowledge application in not just in the context of the classroom, but in the world of work. You know, I use this example all the time, and I'm sorry to repeat it. The board members have heard it a million times, and that is I meet with students all the time. This meeting from a student from one of our high schools who, when we were talking about what are the traits and qualities of a good teacher, and her response to me was, I don't want the teacher just to tell me what the equation is because I can just ask Siri. She did. Ask Siri, what is the equation for? And it was in out of her chemistry class. And Siri told her what the equation was. She said, I need the teacher to tell me why I need to know it and how I'm going to use it. Bingo. And that really gets to the crux of the Common Core, is that switch.
Councilmember Easton.
I get the very comfortable sensation that there's much more group learning here from each other. And the teacher is watching this happen, helping where necessary, but the kids are learning from each other. Now, it took until graduate school for that to happen to me, which kind of horrified me when I found out how great it worked. Because suddenly I can do structural engineering. And I sure as hell couldn't have done that on my own.
That's a very astute observation. Absolutely correct.
Any other questions or comments? All right. We are getting ready to close our meeting and adjourn it. But before that, we'd like to ask any of our board members or council members for future agenda items, if there are some. Dr. Buss?
The one item that I think would be appropriate for both the City Council and the board to look at in the future, especially given that you are doing Parks and Recreation Commission, would be look at those recreational activities that impact both students and community and how that plays for both entities. And I think it's really critical. I grew up in Goleta, and I'm actually grew up across the street from the future park that you're proposing, so very excited about that. So I have a lot of interest in that, and having grown up here, I know how limited even at that point in time my opportunities were to do things like that, so it would be great interest for me to see that.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Buss. Anybody else? Mr. Heron?
It might be nice maybe a year from now to share where bond money has been spent on the Goleta schools. Secondary schools, and what priorities exist for the future.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Heron. Any other future agenda items?
I do have one.
Mayor Aceves.
Thank you. Throughout today's meeting, the word community came out a number of times, and how the school is a community-based, how we're surrounded by neighbors. And one of the things that I'd like to see come back is how we make that more real, in that we talked about bringing the Citizens Academy out here, I heard the CERT program out here. We have a student on our Parks and Rec Commission. And how do we be more involved with our two schools, Dos Pueblos and Goleta Valley Junior High School? How can the community help this your board and your staff get their work done? And what role can the City Council play in furthering those goals? And then finally, as a final note, I just wanted to personally thank President Limon and your colleagues for spending this time with us. I hope we do it again next year. I find this extremely valuable, and I think the community ultimately sees the benefit from it. So. I know it took a long time, and Dr. Cash, I think if you get out and drive slowly, you'll still make it to the recital.
I always drive slowly in Goleta.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Aceves, and likewise, I'd like to thank the city council and the city manager and all the staff and the sheriffs who are here, because it's great to have you on campus. I know we alternate 1 year with the city, 1 year on our campus. So thank you for taking the time and also your genuine interest. And with that, if I hear no more comments or questions, I will adjourn the meeting. Thank you. Adjourn the meeting.